Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. They call me the Booker. And with me is my co-host, 302 pounds from Borger, Texas, the bad man, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
That's actually 320 pounds as of last night. So we talked about this a few weeks back, and I am a guy, I set these high expectations that I'm never able to deliver on. So failure is my middle name in many different ways. But I mentioned a few weeks back about how I'm really looking forward to Fan Fest, and we're gonna do a shitload of eating, Jeff, and we're gonna document it all. But in the interim, before we got to Tampa, I was going to be really good, and it was means no fast food, no soda. I'm going to lose 15 pounds, and guess how I'm doing with all that, Jeff?
I'm guessing you're extra crabby.
Yes, I've lost 2 pounds. So in the last 5 weeks, with all that work that I've done, which really isn't a whole lot of work, I've lost 2 pounds, which means, though, I'm going to eat extra Portillo's, if we do go to Portillo's. But
exactly.
Yeah, but I'm excited, man. This is, every week I look forward to not only discussing the wrestling aspect of what we do, but I love our side conversations. And whether it's a top five list or just a topic or something like that, I get really, really jacked up and really excited about it because, you know, our last episode was diners, and that was just so great, such a great discussion. And this week I'm super excited about our topic.
Absolutely. And here on Breaking Kayfabe, we do not just discuss wrestling. We discuss sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. This is for you, Brian. We are going to break kayfabe on life. So on today's show, we are going to be looking at two of my top 100 matches, including one, Barry, I think you'll agree, is pretty historical for its time.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's absolutely. And so, again, I've said this to you previously, and I've said it on air. When you send me matches and I look, I'm always thrilled if these matches are 15 or 20 minutes long, because generally I don't have an hour. Maybe I just, I have a short attention span where I have to actually watch something for an hour and a half. And I like, oh, man, really? You sent me a match and it's really long, and it's maybe one of my favorite matches of all time now.
Absolutely. And besides that, we are going to take a look at a special passion of my co-host, Barry. In lieu of a top five this week, why don't you tell the good folks listening what we're going to be discussing?
Absolutely. So for all of the cinephiles, all of the people who love movies that listen to us on a weekly basis, we are going to be discussing one of the great movie companies of the 1980s, the company that brought you Kinjite, Forbidden Subjects, Break-In, Bloodsport, Kickboxer, Missing in Action 2 and 3. We're going to be discussing Canon Films. And boy, Jeff, did I give up sleep last night to stay up and go through a list and pull up all my favorites and all these little facts. I'm so excited about this.
Absolutely. So before we get into our match discussion, there are a couple things I want to bring up. On last week's episode, we had taken some questions from the good folks in our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry group. And there were so many good questions, I decided to save some for this episode. So Barry, I'm going to hit you, surprise, surprise, with a couple of the questions we didn't get a chance to answer. So Stan Guzik asked, name a face or a heel that should have been a bigger deal in CWF than they ended up being.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And that was, I did see that question. That's a great question from Stan. Is Guzik his real last name, by the way?
The double Guzik, just like
double Guzik. Absolutely. It's a great question. So two guys immediately spring to mind. Actually, two guys and two tag teams. So from the babyface side, two guys who should have gotten bigger pushes would be Raul Mata. So Raul came in 76. I think it was like the spring or summer of 1976, and got a minor push out of the gate. He was mid-card, actually was getting a few wins. He was kind of unique because we had never seen his style before. At least I had never had in Florida. So I thought he was great. And literally within a year, maybe 2 years, Raul was doing jobs on television. And that was really the way it was for the rest of his career. He was capable of so much more. The second was another guy who got more of a push than Raul got, was kind of respected and generally won, but he was not a main event guy, and he was maybe first three matches at best. And it's Tony Charles, the late Tony Charles, who passed away a year or two ago, and he was unbelievable. And I have this affinity for the British style wrestling. Guys like, you know, Les Thornton and Billy Robinson, obviously, who I've referenced, Jeff Ports, all these guys to me I just thought were incredible. And Tony Charles falls right into that category. I guess his friend, really, the fact that he was short wasn't his friend. You know, the fact he was maybe 5'6 or so, 5'7, he wasn't a tall guy. But what an incredible talent Tony Charles was. On the heel side, I would put forth two tag teams that I think should have done much better and got much more of a push. One is somebody I've referenced previously, the Masked Superstars, Don Green and Jerry Lawler, should have gotten a bigger push, though they did get a push. They never got the Florida tag titles. But we saw Honky Tonk Man, Wayne Ferris and Larry Latham, who was Moondog's spot, and they were a tag team as the Blonde Bombers that came in 79, and literally first and second match, you know, doing jobs for Bubba Douglas and Don Serrano. They got zero push coming in, and they had kind of a unique gimmick. They, you know, I was never a huge Honky Tonk Man fan as far as his in-ring work, but at the same time, the sum of the parts, by putting these guys together, they actually had something going here, and I think Florida could have done a little bit more with them.
Yeah, and I saw, and I've mentioned it before, some of their stuff in Memphis from the late 70s, maybe early 1980, and they were fantastic in Memphis, at least in my opinion. And so, but I understand that that Memphis style didn't always, you know, jive with what was going on in CWF, and maybe Eddie wasn't a big fan of the Memphis style, so that might have had something to do with it. Okay, next question from MD Tyler. Top matches that never happened. Like, in other words, two guys that for whatever reason would have had a great match together or would have been a compelling match, but politics, whatever, injuries, they never had a match together. Barry, anything come to mind for you? Because I've got one definitely.
Oh, man. I don't know. In the old days, in the territory days, it's hard for me to say, like, who faced and who didn't face, and I can't think of anything. Currently, I mean, I think you can do it. Who's your choice?
Well, the match that came to mind immediately for me was Akira Maeda versus Riki Choshu, because, of course, you had the legendary shoot kick incident in late 1987, I believe. And so there was always the question of, boy, those guys could have drawn some kind of crazy, crazy, you know, gate with, you know, Maeda's reputation now as a legit badass, whether it was deserved or not. And Choshu, you know, I'm sure if they would have let him back into the rings of New Japan, he would have had to have, you know, done the honors for Choshu. And that was something, you know, his ego wouldn't let him do. But I mean, you know, the old adage in, you know, the business is, hey, we're here to make money. Let's work with each other. If those two egos could have put what happened aside, they could have made a crazy, crazy amount of money just with that program.
Yeah, that's a fantastic choice as well. I really can't think of anything. You know, I immediately, again, being the old fart, I go back to the territory days, and I start thinking, okay, who was, you know, a top guy in this territory or a top guy in this territory, and maybe they never faced or they never met, but and nothing really comes to mind. From a political standpoint, what you just said, yeah, that's absolutely huge.
You know, I was just, as I was sitting there just running some stuff through my mind, I know one that I don't believe ever happened would have been like maybe Nick Bockwinkel versus Bruno, you know, something like that. You know, I think that could have, you know, Bockwinkel was so great at a certain point in time that I think he could have carried Bruno through some, you know, an unbelievable match because he was that good.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you. So here's, and this is not an answer to your question or MD Tyler's question, but there was a match that took place that I never got a chance to see in Florida, and it was Billy Robinson versus Jack Briscoe, and they actually met a couple of times, and that to me would have been a dream, because as much as I liked the brawling, and I always have, whether it was Bruiser Brody or King Curtis or guys like that, you know, watching guys like Briscoe and Robinson wrestle were, to me, just, that was the reason I think I was there. And if you would have put those two against each other, that just would have been unbelievable. And I think they met two or three times in Florida, a strict babyface wrestling match, but unfortunately it never took place in Miami Beach.
I think there's a famous story, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if you've heard this, about, I don't even want to call it a match that the two of them had in Australia when Billy was over there and Jack came perhaps as the world champion, and they were in a hotel room and they were talking about different wrestling techniques, you know, amateur versus Billy's British Wigan style. And they kind of moved all the furniture out of the way in this hotel room and proceeded in the hotel room to try to have a go at one another to see who could get the advantage. And it was just the two of them. And I can imagine it must have been a pretty crazy evening.
Yeah, so I have heard that story before. And I heard that Jack actually got the better of Billy in that, if it was a match, I guess they were just scrapping too. And I think Robinson was kind of famous for that. He was, you know, he obviously the stories of his attitude and maybe surly attitude are kind of legendary. And I was a huge Billy Robinson fan. I ran his fan club as a 12 and 13 and 14-year-old. So I was a huge fan of Robinson. But at the same time, you hear all these stories about him, you know, either shooting on guys or wrestling outside of the ring on, like, concrete, which to me is just insane. And then there's the infamous story of Billy fighting with Peter Maivia and actually losing the eyesight in one eye as well. So, yeah, it's, you know, again, to be there to see a Robinson and Briscoe match just would have been phenomenal. But imagine being in Australia, and I'm sure that there were other guys in the hotel room, you know. I don't know if Jerry Briscoe was there, because I want to say I'd heard that Jerry Briscoe was there as well. But imagine being a guy and being able to see two of the greatest of all time shooting on each other in a hotel room.
Yeah, that would have been some crazy stuff. Okay, next question. Keith McIntyre wants to know, tell us your favorite or what you thought the top belts. I'm talking about the physical belts that a champion would wear. Barry, why don't you give me your top, three right off the top of your head.
Yeah, so I'm not a belt guy. We have a lot of people. Rodney Sobelson, Bruce Owens, referee Bruce Owens. I'm calling you guys out. These are belt guys. These are guys who know who created Perry Twisdale, guys who created belts, what year the belt was created, whether it was a plate or a cast belt. These guys are incredible with their knowledge. For me, I was never much of a belt guy. My belts are going to go back to my youth. They are not the nicest belts or the prettiest belts. But I would say the old Florida title, especially the one that was used in 1975, the one that Dusty Rhodes and Bob Roop traded a couple of times, that's probably one of my favorites right there. I will say, so being a little more current, which is rare for me, the Ric Flair belt, the Big Goldie, that's a great belt. You brought this up, and 100% I'm going to give you credit for this one. You brought this up when you were discussing Nick Bockwinkel's belt, you know, a month ago, maybe four episodes back. And that belt, to me, signified world heavyweight champion. That was such a classy-looking belt, pure class, when I look at that belt. So those are my three, absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to go with, I absolutely agree, the AWA belt was fantastic. So I thought that one, I thought the North American belt in Bill Watts's Mid-South was a great looking belt. That was also a larger belt. Number three, I'm going to go maybe the WWF belt that Bruno and then Superstar Billy Graham and Bob Backlund had. That belt I thought was a really nice belt. Also, there were some good looking belts in Mid-Atlantic. I know the United States belt that had that red leather attached to it. That was kind of a cool looking belt. So good question from Keith McIntyre. Okay, before we get into our matches, Barry, I want to give a couple of shout outs on birthdays here. Jimmy Superfly Snuka would have had a birthday on May 18th. Andre the Giant. Everyone has that Andre story. And when we go to Fan Fest, we're going to have to do a little poke in the bear with some of the guests there and get an Andre story or two out. His birthday would have been May 19th. The late Chris Benoit, of course, his death shrouded in so much tragedy and anger, well justified on behalf of many. I know, Barry, that you have not allowed yourself and won't allow yourself to watch any Chris Benoit matches because of the circumstances surrounding his death. His birthday would have been May 21st. Brian Pillman, May 22nd. Boy, Brian Pillman is a guy. You talk about guys that get into the business. You know, we spoke before on another podcast that we felt Lex Luger got into the business just as a means to an end, a way to make money. And Brian Pillman was an ex-football player who got into the business. And boy, Barry, he just absolutely grabbed the wrestling business by the throat and wouldn't be denied. And he was a guy that loved the wrestling business.
Yeah, he was pretty awesome too. And I was a Pillman fan, I think, right from the get-go. I saw his Calgary stuff, and what was the tag team called? Was it Bad Attitude or Bad Company? It was
Bad Company. Right? Bad Company with Bruce Hart, yes.
Yeah. And while I liked that, I was a huge fan when he showed up in WCW, and I liked him as a babyface. I just thought he had all the potential to go far. And then when, you know, he turned heel and everything happened with his accident, here was a guy, how smart was he that he was able to, essentially, he couldn't really wrestle anymore. He couldn't do his style, but was able to reinvent himself into this really unique character. So I was a huge Pillman fan. So of all those names that you just mentioned, Jeff, which of those wrestlers had the greatest impact on you?
I mean, I had to say Andre. I mean, you know,
yeah, I'd agree.
Andre was such a well-known figure. Pillman, because Pillman was just coming in. You know, I talked last week about Owen Hart. I was just getting into the Observer when Owen was first breaking out. And likewise, Pillman, not too long after that. So I was closely following Pillman's career. And, you know, there was, as I look at Pillman, as much as they did write about Pillman, he could have been so much more. And, you know, the thing you were saying about how smart he was, not just in life, but in, you know, towards the business. And he had good people advising him too. I'll say that because I know for one, he supposedly, when he came up with, the out of control Brian Pillman character, the loose cannon, I was looking for the word there. He called Terry Funk for advice on how to get the character over. So, you know, you're going to look for advice. That's a pretty good guy to go to, you know?
Yeah.
So, and think about it. Ultimately, here's a guy who's got a foot that's essentially been destroyed because of the accident, but is so good on the interviews and his character is so good and so believable. He gets himself a contract without even showing himself in the ring. I mean, it just shows you how amazing he was. Last guy I want to mention coming up here on May 28th, Kimala, Jim Harris. Boy, Barry, I was watching a little old Mid-South this morning. You talk about a guy. Jim was, let's be kind, not the world's greatest performer in the ring. He was not a great wrestler, but boy, was he a great gimmick. And he took to the gimmick, and talk about, you know, the old Clint Eastwood quote, yeah, a man's got to know his limitations. And I think as Kamala, Jim Harris certainly knew his limitations, and he certainly made a living for himself, even with the within the confines of those limitations.
Yeah, he did too. And I was watching TNA the other night with my son, and there's a wrestler named Congo Kong on. And my son, we're watching the gimmick, and it's odd. You know, this is 2018, and here's a guy that's got tattoos on his body, but he's got face paint, and he's essentially, he's doing a version of Kamala. I don't want to say it's exactly the same, because it's definitely not, but he's doing, I guess, a version, and I forget where they announce him from. I don't know if they say the Congo or deep in the jungles or something like that. And this guy can actually wrestle, but at the same time, it's hard in this day and age that you're taking a guy out of the jungle who's like a, you know, like Kamala was, like a headhunter almost. Kamala was great. He was, you know, what a great gimmick. A real big guy, a real tall guy as well, and heavy set. But there's something that Kamala does or did that I do to this day, and that's I slap my belly. I'll walk around the house just slapping my belly. So it stayed with me some 35, 40 years later. Very, very sorry to hear about the health issues he's had. I believe both legs have been amputated through issues with diabetes. So yes, I'm really sorry to hear that. And I know that he doesn't have a ton of money. And for whatever reason, I don't think the WWE has come forth and helped him. And I never understand how they decide who they help and who they don't help. I'm sure that there's some logic there somewhere that I'm just not understanding. But, you know, he was a guy that just gave, in my opinion, he gave so much to professional wrestling. And when you say Kamala, everybody knows who Kamala is. Even if you're a new fan, you're aware of who Kamala was. You know, he's kind of got that icon status.
And, you know, he had a nice little run with Hogan up in the WWE, late 80s, I want to say, because I can remember a famous magazine cover of the After magazines where Kamala is holding a spear and they've superimposed the face of Hogan, like it's Hogan's head on the end of the spear. That was great. And you know, the whole setup for the character was so brilliantly done where he's in Jerry Jarrett's backyard and the guy doing the voiceover is like, Kamala, coming from the jungles of Uganda. And you know how he's some bloodthirsty savage cannibal, yet somehow he knows how to work a wrestling match.
And I think Memphis, when you say Jerry Jarrett, I think Memphis was where the gimmick first started. He'd been around for a few years as Sugar Bear Harris and Jim Harris. He was in Knoxville, and he was in Oklahoma for Leroy McGurk that I was aware of, and I think the Colkins down in Mississippi as well. But I think Memphis was the first territory, and that's where Kamala was created. And there was it Kimala or Kamala?
Kamala, that's good. It was different in territories. One
was
started
exactly.
with an I.
It was very, very odd. But I remember, it's so funny you say that, and I absolutely remember that image. That had to be from like an After Mag, right?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. So, okay, Barry, it is time for us to delve once again into my top 100 of the 80s list. And we are going to start off with a match from August 8th of 1988. We are talking Antonio Inoki versus Tatsumi Fujinami. Barry, you had a chance to watch this. Tell the good folks what you think about this match.
Oh, boy. So this is the match that I think I referred to at the beginning of this episode, where it's an hour. It's an hour-long match. And a lot of times with those hour matches, it's like, okay, how do I sit in front of the computer? Unless I'm looking at pornography, how do I sit in front of the computer for a full hour, right? And then it's only 5 minutes when I do that. So,
I'll bow to your better knowledge on that, my friend.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'm the only one guilty of that in our entire listening audience as well, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
But as I'm watching this match, I realize I'm watching. First off, how the fuck did this match escape me for the last 30 years? Like, how did that happen? And this match, this is great. I was watching greatness, and I was aware of it. And we're going to discuss another match, and the other match is a good match. There's nothing wrong with it. It's textbook flawless. But as I watch that other match, I'm under the impression that it's two guys going through the motions, doing their spots. And again, it's a very good match, but when I watch this, I believe I'm seeing this is professional wrestling at its finest. And this match, Antonio Inoki versus Tatsumi Fujinami, it's 30 years in just a couple of months. So, you know, to go through, and I'm not going to do this, but to go through this entire match, I wouldn't be able to do that, and then list everything that I saw. But a lot of stuff really stuck out at me. First off, this is probably one of the top five matches that we've ever discussed on this show. And it's an hour. You've got to put forth. And this is a match, and you said this to me, and that's immediately. This was a great selling point. You said, this has got that feel of an old-school Billy Robinson, Dory Funk Jr., Jack Briscoe type of match, and it does. There is so much mat wrestling. They go for submissions. There's chain wrestling to this. There's a point when Fujinami has got Inoki in a figure four, And Inoki is trying to get himself kind of fired up and all that. And Fujinami responds, and he's pushing himself up as far as he possibly could. And just seeing the selling on these two guys' face. And that's the beauty of this match being an hour. And this is where I literally may have to rethink my entire strategy of short versus long is – if this match was 15 or 20 minutes, they never could have put forth the emotion that's available in this match. And as Fujinami's got him in this figure four, just watching them sell this and work this hold, it's unbelievable. The other aspect of this match is the fan involvement from an emotional standpoint. We've talked about it, and especially when we talk about the All Japan women. About, you know, the involvement of the fans and when there are fans crying in the audience. And this is similar. I don't think I caught anybody crying, but at the same time, there's fans that are on their feet for wrestling. This is not because they're brawling, though there's a period here where Inoki slaps the shit out of Fujinami. It's unbelievable. But just as a whole, you know, whether it's the headbutts, you know, there's a Billy Robinson style backbreaker, that Fujinami uses, you know, it's just unbelievable. And these guys are struggling as they're wrestling. I mean, there's just so much going on. They're wrestling and they fall out of the ring as they're in a hold. It's just unbelievable. And the drama of this match, and I wasn't aware of the backstory between these two as far as setting up this match, because even in the beginning, Fujinami goes to shake Inoki's hand, and Inoki looks at him and won't shake his hand. And I Googled, you know, what was the deal here? And then I read the backstory, and it was like, God, this is genius. So this is a match that, you know, and again, I recommend a lot. I recommend every match you put forth on a weekly basis, I'm recommending for the most part, with the exception of maybe one or two at this stage. I'm hard pressed to say that we've actually had a better match. There are matches that might be more exciting on a level of pure excitement, but again, you know, I'm from the old school of the Billy Robinsons, the Jack Briscoes, even current guys like Daniel Bryan, you know, from a few years ago when he'd wrestle these 45-minute matches. They were just phenomenal to me. So this was a real treat to be able to watch this week.
Well, you know, the first thing that I wrote down when I was making notes on this match was, oh, the politics. There was so much that went into this match before it ever took place. So just for a little context, you have to understand that Antonio Inoki he founded the promotion back in 1972. He had been the lead star, the lead babyface for the better part of 16 years. Fujinami was always sort of his understudy, always kind of the guy that, and, you know, pretty much expected that there was a glass ceiling. You know, we talk about promotions having glass ceilings. There was definitely a glass ceiling that the belief was that Tatsumi Fujinami would never break through that glass ceiling. So he becomes the IWGP champion. I'm not even sure if it was in 87 or early 88, but so he becomes the champion. But of course, in order to establish himself, he has to face his mentor. He has to face the great Antonio Inoki. Antonio Inoki, politically speaking, is somewhere on the Hulk Hogan, Vern Gagne, Dusty Rhodes sort of level, where they've got their spot, and by God, they're holding on to it until grim death takes over. They just don't want to give over their spot. So that being said, that's the context that you're dealing with. It'd be kind of like Ric Flair expecting Dusty Rhodes to do a clean finish with no ref bump and no outside interference, but no, Dusty Rhodes just accepts the 1-2-3 from Ric Flair. It'd be kind of like Billy Robinson finally getting that pin. How many times did Billy Robinson and Vern Gagne face each other in the 70s, Barry? And did Billy Robinson ever break through and get that pin? Oh, heck no, because we all know who owned that promotion. Okay, and so that's the context that we're leading to in this match. Tatsumi Fujinami finally breaking through to get the win over Inoki, which, let's be honest, that probably wasn't going to happen, or at least get into a position where he shows enough to where he earns Inoki's respect. So now, that being said, Tatsumi Fujinami, one of the things as I was watching this match, Barry, you know, Lord knows, and since we haven't mentioned this name yet, we all pretty much established your boy crush on Jumbo Tsuruta. Well, as I was sitting there watching this match, I remembered how much of a fan I've always been of Tatsumi Fujinami. You know, you had asked me many episodes ago, if you had a chance to interview anybody from Japanese wrestling from this time frame, who would it be? And I remember I said Riki Choshu, Chigusa Nagoyo, and the third was Tatsumi Fujinami, because I was a huge mark for Tatsumi Fujinami, and I was a huge mark for him mainly because he was a great, great wrestler. I mean, this guy could do it all. He was New Japan's Jumbo Tsuruta. And so the match begins, and the guys come to the ring. Fujinami is being, you know, has an entourage with him. Antonio Inoki comes out by himself. And trust me, folks, there is nothing that Antonio Inoki ever did that didn't have some sort of planned foresight. And he was being, he wanted himself portrayed as the lone wolf, because you had the older generation of fans for New Japan who were huge Inoki marks. So you got the Inoki. We talk about these babyface matches where it's a 50-50 split down the crowd. Then Fujinami has his fans that all want him to shatter that glass ceiling, because the people that are fans of Fujinami, they know the politics that's going on in this whole routine. Okay. So, Inoki always wanted the New Japan fans, because he'd had the mixed martial art matches, so, as if he was like the world's greatest shooter. He like wanted to be Luthez or Carl Gotch or one of those guys, or Billy Robinson, like you said. And, you know, the fame of Inoki, I wrote down, think about it. Hulk Hogan had established himself as a huge deal in this country before, say, 1982-ish. He was an emerging star that everyone saw as being a guy that was, you know, box office gold. And then he makes Rocky III. And it just, it like set a rocket on his back and catapulted him. Well, the Inoki match with Muhammad Ali, who was a bigger name not only in sports but in the world than Muhammad Ali, and the rub that Inoki got off that in his own country, he was set for life as a figure that was always going to be this mega, mega star. So they start the match, and I was, as they start the match, I was recalling that it was a little about a year before that, that the whole new versus now feud started in New Japan, where it was the new guys versus the now guys, which is a nice way of saying the older guys. So this match, when it took place, Antonio Inoki was 45 years old. God bless him. You can't deny, Barry, he was in great shape for a 45-year-old guy. Fujinami, 34 years old. Okay. And it kind of reminded me, Barry, if 5 years before, we've talked before about how much we both admire and respect Giant Baba as a promoter, maybe one of the two or three greatest promoters of all time, because Baba, in his position as the main event guy for All Japan, he knew when to step aside and allow Jumbo Tsuruta to become the star of his promotion. So I was thinking to myself, this match in context would have been like if about 5 to 7 years before there had been a match between Baba and Tsuruta, where Baba establishes in the ring that Tsuruta is the new star of the promotion. And that's what was happening here. This was the way for Inoki to give the rub to Tatsumi Fujinami as the new, you know, lead guy in the promotion. So, as you said, very much a 70s style match, because, you know, they're doing a lot of mat work. But it's really coming across, and you're absolutely right. I think you mentioned this, Barry. It was like a sporting event, you know, not a UFC fight, but this is like going to some sort of match where this wasn't much like you said, a match like that we're going to discuss later. This was a match that was a real athletic sporting contest where two guys were, you know, showing their abilities on the mat. You know, there were a couple high spots in the mat, a match, but even still, it wasn't like, you know, there was no, you know, high spots off the top rope or anything like that. There was a, you know, roll out of the ring kind of thing, but there was nothing that you would sit there and say, boy, that looks really phony. Nothing like that at all. So, Inoki does.
Yeah, you're right about that too. There is at no point. It does. It has a real feel to it, and you almost get the feeling that. And you can, again, you can look at the people in the crowd in the audience, and you can look at the expressions, and they're standing for the mat, for the stuff that they're doing on the mat. The mat wrestling. I mean, when do you ever see fans so into a match that they're standing for that? You don't.
And as I'm sitting here thinking, I think this might have been, with the benefit of hindsight, this might have been the last match of this style. Because, you know, Flair and Steamboat was great, but it was great for a completely different reason. And, you know, Dynamite and Tiger Mask, and even into the 90s, you know, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, those kind of matches, or Steve Austin and you know, WWF. There was nobody wrestling, you know, doing mat wrestling for 60 minutes. And, you know, I sit there and say this, and I'm sure there might be somebody listening going, oh, my God, mat wrestling for 70, you know, for 60 minutes. How boring could that be? No, I'm telling you, this is not a match you sit there and, you know, 25 minutes in, you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I woke up. I fell asleep for a no, because this match grabs you, and the emotion and the way, God bless him, that Antonio Inoki can manipulate a crowd. It's, dare I say, Hogan or Dusty-esque. Barry, this guy could work a crowd.
Yeah, too. And so I was never a fan of Inoki, and it's
no, neither was I, not at all.
Yeah, but a lot of people weren't. There was always something that when you looked at Inoki, you didn't understand why he was considered, at least in my opinion, why he was considered one of the biggest stars in Japan. And, you know, at the time, I could never get it. I understood Tiger Mask. I certainly got it. Shiruda, I got. Choshu, I got. But I never understood, why is Inoki considered such a big star? And then you watch this match and you go, okay, I get it. Now I understand it. He's got this charisma, and it's not your typical, it's not your Hulk Hogan, The Rock type of charisma by any means. It's like an understated charisma. And it conveys to the crowd, but he does come across as a badass, but at the same time, not a guy that's trying to be a badass, not like a Stone Cold Steve Austin badass.
So Here's a name that just popped in my head. Sure. He's got a charisma like a Jack Briscoe. You know, Jack Briscoe was never over the top Stone Cold Steve Austin kind of babyface,
right,
but he exuded that this guy's a badass thing. And that's what Inoki has in his own way. You know, he exuded this is not a guy you want to trifle with kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely too. And even Fujinami, you know, Fujinami was always a solid wrestler. I think where Fujinami lacked, at least what I had seen, and I saw Fujinami a couple of times in Florida. He wrestled Mike Graham at a very famous match at the Hollywood Sportatorium. But, and even watching video of Fujinami, technically, he's as sound as anybody who's ever worked a match, but there was a charisma factor that was missing, and it didn't always convey to the crowd, to the audience. However, in this match, that's all out the window, because he's able to connect with the audience in a huge way.
Now, 1988 was definitely the year in the life of Tatsumi Fujinami where everything came together. As I recall, I believe he won the Wrestling Observer Wrestler of the Year because he just had great match after great match. Unfortunately, it did not extend much longer than that because I want to say it was either late 88 or early 89 that he suffered a back injury, I believe wrestling Vader, and was really, honestly, never the same after that. But all the events that led up to this match. So it ends up, and I'm looking at some of the, in other words, there's a spot where Fujinami is in the figure four and they roll, and with the figure four still attached, they both roll out of the ring. There's a moment in about 41 minutes in where Inoki has the octopus hold, which is his famous finishing maneuver. And, you know, Fujinami is holding on. They do a crowd shot. And as Barry discussed, the emotion coming out of the crowd is just almost palpable. Then we're talking 43 minutes in. You can just see the sweat drenched. You know, the guys are drenched in their own sweat from what they're exerting physically. And Inoki, just, as Barry said, just starts slapping Fujinami. And he's just potatoing him with these slaps. And then at 45 minutes, he picks up Fujinami in the backbreaker. And, you know, who did you say was a backbreaker?
Billy Robinson.
Yeah, and I've seen Bruno put that backbreaker on people where they literally have them on their shoulders and they're like wrenching the back and it just looks so like debilitating. And so anyway, spoiler alert, the match goes 60 minutes. It's a 60-minute draw. And, you know, Barry, we talked before about a 60-minute draw, and that was the Bockwinkel-Hennig match that was the ESPN match, the AWA ESPN match that went 60 minutes. And what a great match that was. Here again, as I sit there and I looked – after this match was over, and I was like, wow, how in God's name did this match not make my top 20? Hell, how did this match not make my top 10? This was a top 10 for the entire decade match. And boy, I got to tell you, that kills me to say that because I really was not a fan of Inoki, but he was brilliant in this match. He was brilliant psychologically. He was absolutely the physical match for Fujinami. Fujinami was great in this match. Inoki was great in this match. Big round of applause for both guys. And there's a great spot at the end of the match where it's a draw and it's time for the ring announcer to hand Fujinami the belt. And what happens, Barry? Inoki takes the belt. He walks over and he puts the belt around Fujinami's waist. Don't kid yourself, folks. That was a key moment for the fans at ringside and the fans in that building that night and the fans that watched on TV, that was Inoki putting over Fujinami, and he had never done that before. And at that point, Ricky Choshu comes in the ring, lifts Inoki up on his shoulders, carries him around the ring. Kingo Kimura, Tatsumi Fujinami's longtime partner, puts Fujinami on his shoulders, and both men are paraded around the ring on the shoulders of the two men. And it was very gripping emotionally to see that, because you can see both men almost begin crying, Barry, that, you know, the release of the emotions from what they've gone through athletically, and now the emotion of what has happened, where Fujinami has finally gotten the rub from his longtime mentor.
Yeah, I think that's the first standing ovation, Jeff, you've given a match.
Oh, man, this is great stuff.
Yeah, I could tell you were standing on that one, too. Well, maybe not.
I don't know.
No, all right. But it really is. And it's at a different level. And, you know, you just referenced another great hour-long match, and that is the Curt Hennig versus Nick Bockwinkel. And I would say there's a lot of similarities. Take out the fact it's an hour-long draw. It's the older champion versus the young up-and-coming star. You know, the passing of the torch, in a sense.
Great point.
But at I'm sorry?
Great point. Absolutely.
Okay, but at the same time, the similarities are there, and it's almost like you've got the Japanese version versus the American version. I think I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch that Hennig Bockwinkel match one more time. I watched this match this morning. You know, literally 2 hours ago, I was watching this match, so it's super fresh with me. But I think when we hang up. We're finished recording in our palatial studios. I am going to go back and watch that match so I can do like a mental comparison of the two, but maybe two of the best pure wrestling matches that we've seen.
Absolutely. Okay. It is now time for us to move to our second match for this episode. So I got to give a little caveat, folks. On my top 100 list, there is a match from June 1st, 1985 that took place in the New Orleans Superdome, Ric Flair versus Terry Taylor, who was the North American champion at the time. Well, guess what? Sometimes life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. I can't find this match anywhere. I used to have it. As I've mentioned before, I gave away a lot of my tapes to John McAdam. Mr. John, I can't find your tapes, McAdam. And so this match is not on there on YouTube. It's not in there on Daily Motion. Nothing. I can't find this. This was a match that was shot by Joel Watts at ringside for his father. And so it was not a match that was ever shown on Mid-South television. It was, I guess, basically for Bill Watts's private collection. And that it was a great 5-star match. And I really wish I could share it with you. So what we've done instead was we took a match from the 28th of April, 1985. I believe this match took place in Oklahoma City. I reached out to a couple friends, Roy Lucier and Mike Mills, asked them, and they both said it was not New Orleans. That was my initial thought. So I believe this was Oklahoma City. And this is the match that we're going to talk about. And as Barry said, a perfectly fine match. It kind of honestly pales a little bit in comparison to the first match we discussed. But Barry, you had a chance to watch this. Tell me what you thought about this match.
Yeah, you're 100% right. This match is from Oklahoma City, and this is not the more famous match that took place in New Orleans. Have you ever heard Terry Taylor's story about the New Orleans match?
I was sitting with him at a table here in Fort Lauderdale at a restaurant when he told it to us.
Yeah, because he goes into great length. It's probably a good 4 or 5 minute story, and he talks about it on that Legends of Mid-South DVD set that the WWE put out 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, whatever it's been. But that's a hell of a story. And because he told you that story in person, I actually will defer to you to tell that story because I think it's fantastic. It's such a great testament to Ric Flair in so many ways. So this is a good match. Let's be honest. And had I not seen the other match, which, you know, again, it's right up there, I think, with that Curt Hennig and Nick Bockwinkel match, I would be raving about this match. But having seen them both within 24 hours of each other, I can't rave about it. And a lot of it has to do with this comes across to me as a worked professional wrestling match. They're getting their spots. as you and I discussed last week, Flair does the same spot with the referee, who this time is Carl Fergie. It isn't Tommy Young, but he's doing the same thing where he pushes him, and the referee pushes him back, and this goes on three or four times, and then Fergie shows him. He pulls at his shirt to show him that he's the referee, and Flair backs down. So this is a very good match, and I had a ton of thoughts as I was watching this, and I'm going to throw some stuff your way and get your opinion. This is a Flair match. He's doing all of his spots. It's everything that you've seen Flair do for years. But at the end of the day, I'm watching a Flair match, and I've seen these spots 100 times. And when I was watching that Inoki Fujinami match, I'm seeing shit that I had never seen before, and certainly I'm not seeing on a regular basis, on a regular weekly basis at least. So this is a good match. There is no commentary at all, which I like. I actually enjoyed that fact. Taylor's career and Taylor as a heel. So you had dinner with Terry Taylor, and he was very charming and very nice to you. So I've had interaction with Terry Taylor, and I didn't walk away as a fan. I walked away going, God, what an incredible fucking douchebag this guy is that is so full of himself. And Taylor's career, and I know there's going to be people out there that'll go, well, I've had a great experience with Terry Taylor, and I'm sure that you have. At the end of the day, and I'm sure that to some people, Terry Taylor's a wonderful human being. But at the same time, there's a lot of stories about Terry Taylor being a douchebag. And Terry Taylor's career outside of the Mid-South area, it never went anywhere. And a lot of that, from everything that I've heard, had to do with how people perceived him as kind of this egotistical, arrogant dickhead. And I'm being blunt. I'm speaking very honestly right now. And Terry Taylor, as an in-ring performer, I think he had it. I think Terry Taylor should have been and could have been a much bigger star than he was. Take out the Mid-South Bill Watts region, because he obviously was pushed. He was over there. I think he was a huge favorite of Watts, without a doubt. But at the same time, Terry never did a whole lot in the NWA. I think he was national champion at one point, but he never got into main event feuds or anything like that. He became a joke in the WWE, and I think partly that was done to try to humble Taylor, from what I've heard, with the Red Rooster gimmick, which was just a horrific gimmick at the end of the day. It's certainly not something that's going to endear you to professional wrestling fans. It's being viewed at as kind of a laughing stock, and Taylor, as an in-ring performer and as an interview, was capable of a lot more. He was fantastic, regardless of what his personality was like outside the ring. The guy was absolutely incredible. In my opinion, Taylor is a heel, especially. I loved that whole shit, that whole setup in the UWF, where he was a partner with Chris Adams. And he turned on Chris Adams and kicked the foot off the rope, if you remember, and it went on for a few weeks, and then he joined up with Eddie Gilbert, and they had that, and I'll never forget this, and you and I have talked about this, but they had that press conference with Terry Taylor and Eddie Gilbert and Chris, and it's like, there's like five people at the press conference. It's like Tommy Gilbert, who's the referee, and then I think Dennis Brent, who was doing the Mid-South magazine, and they threw a couple of other people in there, and then Chris Adams shows up, and I'll never forget, and I just thought this was so much fun, that when Adams and Taylor get into it, Taylor goes to hit him with an ashtray, but he looks at the ashtray and empties it out first, and then hits him with him. Like, he's being so considerate. I can't hit you with a dirty ashtray. Like, it's such a great spot, and it stays with me 31 years later, 32 years later, whatever it's been, but it was just such a great spot. And I think Taylor, and I think right after this happened, Taylor got into a car crash and had a serious issue with his stomach, where he had to have some sort of surgery and he was out of action. And I think it was a missed opportunity, because Taylor is a heel, my opinion, main event stuff. And again, I'm telling you that I think he's kind of a dickhead, but at the same time, let's be honest, this was a guy that I think could have drawn and made serious money and could have been a main event heel in the NWA or the WWE. And certainly not an opponent for Hogan, but maybe on a level of a Kurt Hennig, maybe right below, maybe an Intercontinental champion or whatever the championship was at that time. So, and then the other thing that I saw when I was watching this was Taylor as an opponent for Flair. These two work fantastic together. He's right below Steamboat, in my opinion, as an opponent for Flair. And that's saying a lot, because the perfect opponent for Flair, I think we all agree, was probably Steamboat. But Terry Taylor, he's right there for anything that happens in this match. He and Flair, this is like a dance. These guys are absolutely incredible working together. The other thing that comes to mind is Taylor with the girls. This guy was another thing, and this is where Watts fully understood Terry Taylor's appeal. With Terry Taylor with the girls, boy, this guy was over. And he was almost, as I'm watching, it's kind of a Mid-South version of the Von Erichs as far as the relationship with the female members of the audience, because he could do no wrong with the girls. And Terry Taylor is a good-looking guy. I mean, you know, even to this day, I think he is a very handsome young man, or old man at this point. So, Terry, I have a lot of feelings on Terry Taylor, obviously. My first interaction with him, I should say, was in Florida when I was a kid. And I guess he's probably 4 or 5 years older than me, maybe a little bit more than that. But he was a rookie, and he was working Florida prelims. And he would be in the back, and people would go up for his autograph. And he was just, unless you were an attractive female, he wasn't a nice guy, even as a rookie, which is odd. You know, you just generally don't see that. But your interaction with him at the dinner was really positive, right?
Well, I'll tell you a couple things about the dinner that we had that, of course, here, let me be the shill author here. The story in its entirety is available in my book, Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Legends of Wrestling, available at crowbarpress.com. Okay, I've got
that. Can I say something about that, too? This is a great fucking book, and I'm not saying that because Jeff and I are related. It's not. If you want an honest book of what it's like to sit down at a table and to have dinner with a legend, and guys like Ric Flair and guys like, you know, Bob Orton Jr. and you know, Kevin Sullivan, and just, there's just, you know, there's with Barry Windham. There's probably 20 names in this book, and I don't know the exact number. Is there 20 names?
You just named two guys that I wasn't at those dinners, but thank you for putting over the dinner.
Sorry, man, but it's absolutely incredible, because when you sit here and you get this kind of very honest look at a career, and it's such a unique concept. And, you know, we certainly, you know, when I say we, the CWF Fan Fest, we certainly kind of glommed onto that a bit, where we wanted to offer a dinner with a legend experience. And it's not as intimate. You know, with you, it was you and maybe three or four other individuals, Greg Good and a couple of other guys, Bob McKeon, and a couple of other guys whose name escapes me. But and that's definitely a shot that I just took right there. But I didn't want that to go unnoticed. But at the same time, we definitely took that idea. And while ours are larger, the idea would be that, you know, at these dinners that took place, Jeff was the guy really asking the questions. And Jeff was the guy, and I don't want to say it was an interview because it wasn't, but Jeff was the one that was reaching out, doing history, lining up guys' careers so he could discuss this at the dinner table. And as always, you wanted to have your facts correct. So we tried to do that. But this book is so cool. And you know, again, it's, I think a lot of it, when I look at it, is that you'll never get this. This wasn't an interview. And in an interview, guys are always on their guard. You know, that's a big thing. When you do an interview with somebody, they're on their guard. They're waiting for that one question that's going to kind of just send them out a little bit. And with this, because there's alcohol involved, there's great food involved. You were eating at Chima, right? That's, you know, one of the best restaurants in the country, I think. These guys are much more relaxed, and that comes through in the book. And that's a really important thing. So to that end, Jeff, as I did a 5-minute promo for the book is available. You can go to crowbarpress.com through our good friend Scott Teal. Or you can also get an autographed copy of this book if you're in Tampa in just a few days, Jeff, at CWF Legends Fan Fest 3, taking place at the Marriott Residence Inn at Suncoast Parkway in Lutz, Florida. So I hope to see you guys there. I hope that everybody's there. And if you don't have a copy of this book, again, you can get a copy. It'll be autographed by Jeff, and you can get a photo with Jeff holding the book as well.
Wait a minute now. I have to see if I can squeeze back into these headphones because my my head is so enlarged now from the ego expanding.
A fucking promo.
It really was.
I'm on like 3 hours of sleep again. My kid went to a local prom, not his school prom, but somebody else's prom. A girl said, would you come with me? And he said, I would absolutely do it. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm picking him up from this strange girl's house, which is great. So I'm on 3 hours of sleep. That was a fucking promo. That was almost, but not quite, Bobby Fulton-esque.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
And kudos to you and your wife for giving the kid apparently the 3 o'clock curfew. That's not what I had on my prom, I can tell you that. So
all right,
let's get back to Terry Taylor. Yes, I did have dinner with him. It was kind of interesting because there were parts of the dinner where he was extremely open. And he told us, you know, some very funny stories because he's a guy that was in Florida. He told us about getting his start in Florida, going up to Georgia. He told us some very funny stories about working in Mid-South. And I'll tell two things that stuck out with me is I asked him a question that I've always had that no one, unless by God, we get Bill Watts to be interviewed, that we're never going to be able to have this question answered, is the UWF tournament. You've left Mid-South. You're becoming the Universal Wrestling Federation. It's time for a one-night tournament in Houston, Texas to crown the person that will be representing your company. And Bill Watts isn't there. I still don't understand that. So I asked Terry, I said, why wasn't Bill there? He goes, I don't know. Maybe he wanted the night off, which I thought was a very, if that was the case, it's a very peculiar evening to take the night off. The other story that I can't tell in its entirety for certain reasons was Terry told us a very amusing story about something that happened when he was working Memphis. I'll just leave it at that. And at the end of the evening, I mentioned something about because what I was doing was I was sharing these stories on, I believe, Pro Wrestling and whatever John McAdams site. I was sharing it with, you know, Barry's sites, the different Florida pages that he have. I would do a transcript of the interviews and I would share it on these particular websites or Facebook pages. And so I made a comment to Terry about how, okay, well, this will be on the Facebook page another couple of days. And he turned and looked at me and he goes, it's going to be what? And I think he was at the time thinking of the particular story that he had told me. And you just saw the look of blind panic in his face. And I was like, no, don't worry. You know, because any writer that thinks of themselves as a good writer knows what to print and what not to print. And so here's a big spoiler alert. As good as I like to think the book is, and as much as I appreciate Barry putting over the book, you know, folks, I'm sorry. There are certain things that you have to sit there as you're being told a story and go, yeah, I'm not going to be able to put this in the book. You know, I mean, that's just, it happens not only with wrestlers, it happens with, you know, if you're interviewing anybody, politics, entertainment, sports, whatever, you know, you have to know when to self-edit. And at that point, I knew I was going to self-edit. Terry did not realize that. It was momentarily panicked until I assured him that some of the stuff that was mentioned that night was not going to make the pages of the Facebook pages there. So let me get back to the match now. So the first thing I made mention of, you know, Terry Taylor, you mentioned this, Barry, he had a great look. There was no doubting it. And you really wonder, and you pointed this out, why wasn't this guy a bigger deal? Because, you know, here, Magnum TA the year before had moved on and gone over to Crockett and was getting the big push from Dusty. So Bill Watts needs a guy to replace Magnum TA as his lead babyface. He puts Terry Taylor in the spot. Terry Taylor was getting over. 1985 was a great year in Mid-South. There was, you know, Bill Dundee was the booker. Whether or not that had something to do with that, because Terry would have known Bill from their days in Memphis, I don't know. But he gives Terry the run with the belt. And I thought Terry made for a very credible champion. He was doing some good stuff. As a matter of fact, I was just watching this morning. I mentioned I was watching an episode of Mid-South. I happened to be watching the episode where he lost the belt to Randy Colley as the Nightmare with Eddie Gilbert and Ric Flair at ringside. And that's available out there on YouTube for anybody who wants to see it. And it kind of struck me as, you know, the Nightmare, you got a guy in a mask. And it was kind of an odd choice, I thought, to replace Terry Taylor is the North American champion. And I think the Nightmare held the belt, I want to say, for, geez, a good 4 or 5 months. So it wasn't like, they give the guy the title change. And then a week later, Bill Watts decided to put it on another babyface. So, Terry Taylor was he had a great look. And you wonder why, when he went to the NWA, why wasn't he thought of as a bigger deal? When he went to the WWF, why didn't they put him in a better spot? And it was interesting because I also had a chance. There was about a 2-minute interview with Bobby Heenan on YouTube, where Bobby Heenan discusses, because of course the Brooklyn Brawler and Terry Taylor as the Red Rooster had a little bit of a mid-card program. And Bobby made a point of saying that he was embarrassed to be a part of that particular program. And he really never considered Terry Taylor as a guy that was ever going to be a real big deal, that Terry Taylor just never came across to him that way. He never, showed Bobby, who had been around the business forever, he never showed him anything that a main eventer would have showed him, which I thought that was kind of interesting. So the match in question is about a 30-minute match. Barry, you pointed out the Tommy Young spot with Ric Flair. I will point out that they did the Tommy Young spot not once but twice during this match. And there's a great moment where they're out on the floor, and Joe Watts is at ringside shooting the film for his dad. And he gets in the way of Flair running Taylor into the ring post. And there's a great moment. Flair gets back on the apron, turns back to Joel Watts and says, "Get the hell out of my way," which I thought was kind of funny. 1985, Barry, let's take a look at 1985. I'm thinking that 1985 was Ric Flair's last great year as a traveling world champion. Would you agree with that?
I would too. And you asked a question, was it last week or the week before? A couple of weeks back, where you said, so pre-corporate Ric Flair or corporate Ric Flair? And this kind of falls into it. And you're right. Yeah, so I would say 85, because he was traveling everywhere. I don't think he was back in Mid-South after 85, right?
No, I think the end of 85, when they did the famous angle with DiBiase and Murdoch, might have been the last time that Flair was ever there. I'm thinking, I can't really remember anything after. But you take a look at, I was thinking about some of the guys. He went in, he faced Terry Taylor. In Mid-South, he had some matches, I want to say, with maybe like Butch Reed. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think he was in early in 1986. But for the entirety of the year, he went to Florida. He had matches with Wahoo. I think latter part of the year, he might have had his first match with Luger. So he was in Florida. He was obviously in Mid-South. He was obviously still going to Texas and facing Kerry. He faced Kerry up in St. Louis in some very memorable matches. Had a match with Bruiser Brody in St. Louis also that was great. So, yeah, so Flair was still traveling. And as a matter of fact, I recall, I want to say it was in October of 85, he went over and they had an AWA versus NWA match with Flair and Rick Martel. So he was still a traveling champion. That's my point. Whereas around 86, for the majority of the year, he became more of a Crockett guy. And that's where he was only defending the belt in South Africa, to mention Southeast in 1985. I believe he was still going down and defending the belt there. So when I say that was the last great year for Ric Flair, I mean as a traveling world champion. So and then I think that was the last chance he really had to meet a wide variety of different wrestlers and different territories. So there's an interesting spot in this match that I particularly like, where Flair knocks Taylor out of the ring. And, there's a famous spot that Bob Orton used to do where he would fall out of the ring and he would hook his feet on the ring ropes. And so he'd be hanging like maybe about a foot off the floor. And in this particular spot that Terry Taylor does, he's hanging with one foot. I think he gets his foot caught in the rope and he hangs there for a good 20 seconds as Flair's putting the boots to him. That was the crowd really gets into this match about the 20-minute mark and they become really invested. But here's the shocking thing. We have a 30-minute match and Ric Flair gets put over. Absolutely 100% strong. I believe. Now you tell me, Bear, what you thought about this. Did Taylor submit or did the ref stop the match?
The ref stopped the match. So okay. I actually had to go back and I had to watch it again and go, Taylor never does like the tap out or anything like that. So I think the ref stops the match.
But it is still a case of Flair being put over very strong as the world champion. And, Taylor, because he never submitted, as you said, he can still retain his heat as a babyface. So it was very effective. So now that we're done with that, Barry, any last thoughts on this match?
Yeah, so actually I have a question. So somebody reached out to me this week, and it's somebody that I've known for years, and we're not actually wrestling friends per se, but he does watch professional wrestling, and we've discussed it. It's somebody I worked with years ago, and he just watched the 30 for 30 documentary on Flair, and he asked me a question. He texted this to me, and he said, I'm going to read it verbatim. He goes, if Flair did not take the same name and look from Buddy Rogers, would Flair be just as successful? It came to mind when that ESPN 30 for 30 episode on Flair replayed recently. And I thought that was a really interesting question, coming from somebody who's not a hardcore wrestling fan by any stretch. And it caused me to think. And my response was, I think so. He would have created another gimmick. And but I don't know if that's correct. I think that was my response, but I don't really know if that's actually correct, though, what I said. So what do you think about that?
Well, I know famously when Flair first started in the AWA, he wanted to be called Dirty Ricky Rhodes. He wanted to be Dusty Rhodes' little brother. And that's what he wanted. And I remember hearing the story that Rose and Murdoch said, no, you don't want to do that. You want to have your own identity. And your own. So think about what Ric Flair would have been if he had, in fact, become Ricky Rhodes, the brother of Dusty Rhodes. Would his career have taken off like it did? Now you have a guy that was so internally driven and had such a desire to be a star that, you know, I'm sure that's not going to be able to be nipped in the bud, especially during that time frame. Now, if Ric Flair had shown up in the, you know, like say the early 90s as a young 21-year-old, you know, driven and, you know, wanting to be a success. Well, at that point, the business had changed so much that I'm sure there were a lot of guys at that time frame that got beaten down by the politics of wrestling. So, but at the time period that Ric Flair was coming up, you know, geez, think about how many great wrestlers came out of not only the AWA in the early to mid 70s, but in wrestling itself. But a guy with Flair's passion for the business, his love for what the business brought him, whether that's the partying lifestyle, the women, you know, he was so committed to being a success that I think he would have been a success even if he had to come up with some other gimmick.
Do you think he would have been on the same level, though, as we know the Nature Boy Ric Flair? So granted, I agree with you, he would have been successful no matter what because he was driven. He always wanted to be the best. And again, if you've got that in you where you can party all night and then go out and wrestle a great 60-minute match, you're going to be successful. At the same time, if he had taken on another gimmick, and it would have you know, it's hard to imagine Flair doing anything else. Would he have been as successful as he was with that other gimmick, do you think?
Maybe not as successful, but I think he would have had some level of success, obviously. And, you know, now that you're sitting here talking, I just realized that I never went into the story about the New Orleans night, Barry. So let me just you kind of threw the ball to me and I was supposed to knock it out of the park and I completely forgot about the question. So the story that Terry Taylor tells, for those of you that have never heard it, it is out there, is the night of the Superdome. Terry Taylor is in a football stadium going after the world champion. And he acknowledged at the dinner that this was the biggest match of his career, that this was the match that, you know, this was everything that he had been leading to as a wrestler for all the years he's training and stuff like that. So he's in the dressing room and he says, you know, he goes, I've got my hair is perfect. And he goes, and, you know, it's still 30 minutes left before the match, but I'm, you know, I'm there and I've got myself, you know, prepped and ready to go. And he goes, and I want to discuss the match with Flair so we can come up with whatever the finish is going to be. And so I kind of send word. I said, tell Rick, I need to talk to him so we can figure out what the finish is going to be. And so word comes back that it's 30 minutes. Now, mind you, the card is going on here. Okay. So let's just figure they're probably in a fourth, fifth match into the card. And the word comes back that Rick hasn't got to the building yet. So Terry begins, obviously, to kind of freak out like, oh, my God, this guy is, you know, I'm supposed to have a match. And I believe the match was called for it was going to be a 60-minute draw. So Terry wanted to have an idea of what they were going to do to get to that 60-minute point. And so the word comes back that Rick's not there. And Terry begins to not panic, but he's like kind of like, okay, this is not good, not good. And he's like, well, I want to know when he gets here. So about another 10 minutes goes by. So now we're 20 minutes before they're supposed to come out to the ring here in the New Orleans Superdome. And I'm sure they had, you know, somewhere 20, 25,000 people there. And the word comes back that Ric Flair has arrived. So Terry goes over to the dressing room. That's Ric Flair's dressing room. He walks into the dressing room and he says, Ric Flair absolutely looks like a complete wreck. I mean, he says he's basically one step above a homeless guy because he's been out all night and partied all day, and he just looks a mess. And Taylor's sitting there looking at him. He says, I'm thinking to myself, I got to go 60 minutes with this. How in God's name is that ever going to happen? This guy is a mess. And Flair looks up, bloodshot eyes, hair's a mess. He looks at Taylor and he goes, get me a cup of coffee. And Taylor says, I think to myself, get me a cup of coffee. Get me a cup of coffee. Buddy, I'm wrestling the main event of the Superdome with you. Who are you to tell me to get a fucking piece of a cup of coffee? But I go over, I get him coffee. I sit there, hand it to him. I said, hey, what's the finish going to be? We'll work something out. Don't worry about it. So now they come in and they tell Terry, time to go to the ring. He gets his call. So Terry heads to the ring and he's like, oh God, this is just going to be such a shit show. I've seen what the guy looks like in the dressing room. And the light goes to the portion of the building where Ric Flair is making his entrance. And Terry's like just dreading what he's going to see. And the light, the silhouette or whatever hits the spot where Flair is supposed to come out. And he looks and Ric Flair comes out and he looks like a million bucks. Terry said he couldn't believe his hair was perfect. The robe was perfect. He had become Ric Flair after one cup of coffee and no sleep because he'd been out in the French Quarter the entire night. And he comes into the ring and they work a 60-minute match. And Terry Taylor said, I couldn't believe that this guy, and it was, by all accounts, it was a 5-star match on the old Meltzer scale. And the match ends after the 60 minutes. They both go back to their respective dressing rooms. And Terry says, I want to go over to Rick's dressing room and tell him what a great match that was, shake his hand. And he goes, I go over to the dressing room, open his door, and he's gone. His gear is gone. He's already out back into the French Quarter, ready for another night. That was Ric Flair, folks, back in the mid-80s.
And that's absolutely an incredible story. And that is the story, too. It's that's Ric Flair. That's Ric Flair. Yeah.
Okay, so before we get into our special look at the Canon Film Group, Barry, excuse me, we had a couple more questions that I thought were good questions that I wanted to throw at you. Barry does not know these questions, so we're going to do this on the fly and see if Barry can respond. Our old friend John Doe, ask on the board, Barry, give me your top three ELO songs.
Oh, shit. Evil Woman, It's a Living Thing, and, oh, shit. I guess Rock and Roll is King. Sure. Rock and Roll is King.
Ricky and Robert's intro song. That was great. And by the way, It's a Living Thing. Was there ever a greater exit to a movie than Boogie Nights when Dirk Diggler drops Trow and ELO's It's a Living Thing kicks in, Barry?
No, that was great, too.
Yeah,
and
that was
certain songs. Isn't ELO, aren't they touring this summer?
Well,
think they're coming to the U.S.
I think they call it Jeff Lynne's ELO, because let's be honest, Jeff Lynne was really, he was really pretty much ELO, you know, in the same way that some guys are, you know, I'm trying to think of an example of what I'm talking about. Like Tom Schultz was, you know, he had guys in like Brad Delp in Boston, but really Boston was Tom Schultz because he was doing all the wizardry with the music and, you know, and he had Brad Delp's incredible voice, but he was pretty much what Boston was. And I know recently he's toured with Boston, and of course Brad Delp is no longer with us. So, but Jeff Lynne was really ELO. So my three, I'm going Strange Magic, Mr. Blue Sky, and my favorite ELO song has always been Telephone Line. So those are my choices. So now, John Doe, you've got your answer from Barry and I. So,
all good. Very, all good songs, too. Absolutely.
Very important question from Spencer Benson. You know, recently on an episode of one of our brother shows here on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, Mr. Jim Cornette offered his opinions on Wendy's French fries. Not that anyone is accusing anyone of being a gimmick stealer, but Barry, Spencer wants to know, what is your favorite type of French fries? Are you going crinkle, skinny, curly, or waffle?
I hate fucking waffle fries. I got to be honest. So I go to Chick-fil-A, and I love Chick-fil-A. Take out their politics and all the other shit, but that chicken is unbelievable, and I crave it. My issue with waffle fries is a lot of times they're not going to be crispy. They're going to be a little soggy. Occasionally you get your crispy waffle fry, but for the most part you don't. So I'm not a big waffle fry guy. Curly fries, And we'll take Arby's. Arby's does curly fries. The problem with curly fries is that they're seasoned in most cases. And I don't really like a seasoned fry. I like a fry that's deep fried in oil and then some salt on top of it. And that's it. I don't want all these other spices or flavors on it. So to that end, I think we're going to narrow this down now. We're going to go to the thin fry, maybe a steak fry in a crinkle cut. And this was a conversation that you, myself, and the great Brian last had off air the last few days about Nathan's French fries. And I think Nathan's French fries are great. My favorite French fry in the entire world, Jeff, come from McDonald's. And it almost sounds funny to say that because I love pizza and French fries are like my favorite food. I love French fries. But if you go to McDonald's and they're just out, you can they're hot and they've got the right amount of salt on them, I'm in heaven. I love McDonald's French fries. So that's where I'm going to go with my choice. How about you?
I'm saying that I'll go with skinny fries as my favorite. I'll go with, you know, the crinkle fry. Usually I would say the curly, but the other night my wife made crinkle fries and I told her they were the best French fries she'd ever made. And I said, do you know why? And she goes, yeah, because I left them in there longer. So they're cooked a little longer. So they had more of a crunch to them. So crinkle and curly can go 2-3. They can rotate. And the last one is the waffle fry. And I got to tell you something. We go to Chick-fil-A occasionally. The waffle fry that you get from Chick-fil-A, your chances of getting a really good waffle fry, you're batting about 2 out of 5. So for every 5 visits, about twice they're going to get the waffle fry cooked all the way. There's nothing worse than biting into a waffle fry because it's a bigger fry and biting and getting like you're biting into a baked potato. You know, you're getting a little too much, you know, where if they're done a little bit longer and they get a little snap to them, that's when it's done really well. But again, maybe 2 out of 5 times I'm getting that. So,
I have a question for you right now, though. Okay. So regarding Mrs. Bowdrin, is she serving you deep fried French fries or baked?
Oh, no. We have the deep fryer here in the Bowdrin household.
Thank God, Jeff. Thank God. Because yes. A baked French fry is like drinking, like a diet milkshake or some shit like that. You've got to have a deep fried fry. So you just said something else. This is great because I didn't know we were even going to talk about food. So I'm thrilled that we can crowbar in a food conversation. Let me see how long I can actually stretch this out for. So I just mentioned, and you mentioned that you like the long, thin fries, much like I do, kind of like a McDonald's fry.
Exactly.
McDonald's French fries versus Steak and Shake French fries.
Probably McDonald's, because Steak and Shake French fries are good, but they're like almost like a shoestring, you know?
Yeah.
But both are very good. I mean, that's a fair question. So Spencer, good question, my man. Now, Joe Martinez wants to know, Barry, offer up, give me 3 or 4 your top sitcoms ever.
Oh, sure. Cheers, Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, The Middle, currently The Goldbergs. I am completely infatuated with this show. Do you watch The Goldbergs, Jeff?
I do not, but I've heard it's a good show. That's the one set in the 80s, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's set in the 80s, and they always start off saying 1980-something. So they never pinpoint the actual, but it all takes place in the 80s. It's a great show. Those are probably my favorites as far as sitcoms. There was, you know, you go back and you watch a lot of the sitcoms of the 70s and maybe the 80s, and we all have fond memories of certain, like, Family Ties, but have you tried to watch Family Ties in the last decade? It just doesn't, in my opinion, it just doesn't work. And a lot of those sitcoms, they really didn't. And even Cosby Show, take out Bill Cosby, which you fucking destroyed Bill Cosby like 5 or 6 weeks ago, and rightly so. But at the same time, I was watching The Cosby Show when it aired, and it was terrible. Like, it was the most unrealistic show. I remember this one episode, and I'll reference this whenever somebody says The Cosby Show was a great show. And I'm like, no, it was this fucking complete fantasy world that did not exist. But the grandparents were celebrating an anniversary, and all of the grandkids decided to put on a musical performance for them where they're coming down the stairs with, like, top hats and canes. And what fucking world does that take place? So The Cosby Show to me was, you know, and Bill Cosby, obviously one of the bigger scumbags I think ever to exist, because he put on this face of this family man, and at the same time he would chastise all these comedians for the blue humor and using profanity because he was so morally upright, while at the same time he was drugging and raping women. Fucking scumbag. And this should no way equal your rant from a few weeks ago, which was epic. That was a terrible show. And I don't know why I'm on this tangent all of a sudden when we're talking about great sitcoms. But I'll say – that was fun, though. I will say Cheers, Seinfeld, and Curb Your Enthusiasm are my top three, though.
Okay. I'm going Seinfeld, The Office – and Hogan's Heroes, which of course was my favorite, you know, show when I was a kid. Special mentioned, just because I don't want to forget, Perry, how great was WKRP in Cincinnati?
Yeah, and that was a little bit. First off, props on The Office, because if I had thought of The Office, if that had come to me, right, I would have said, yeah, The Office as well, because that was kind of groundbreaking when you stop and think about it. It was great. WKRP was one of those sitcoms that was in the 70s and then came back in the 80s, and it worked. It worked whether it was 70s or 80s, so it was good. Hogan's Heroes I liked. I can't say that it makes my list, and maybe one day we'll talk about the star of the show and what an interesting life he led, because that would make for a great episode. Yeah, absolutely. But that was a great show. There are some great shows. You know, last week we discussed, and I thought this was great. This is actually going to lead into where we're going with Canon Films and why. But a lot of the great sitcoms of, say, the 60s, I learned from watching Dave Dixon on Channel 51, WKID, out of Fort Lauderdale. And Dave Dixon was such an interesting guy. But, you know, a lot of my psyche and a lot of, you know, the reason I guess I gravitate towards the unusual and maybe bizarre things, a lot of that I think came from professional wrestling and Dave Dixon. And shows like Dobie Gillis, which was just an incredible and I don't know if that's not really a sitcom, I guess, Dobie Gillis, but Life of Riley. But he was showing all these great comedy shows from the 60s that I just was like blown away, and I thought these were so cool.
Well, think about shows like The Munsters or Addams Family. Those two were both great sitcoms. And here's another one. You know, a lot of times people, when they think about great TV sitcoms going back, a lot of people talk about I Love Lucy. I got to be honest with you. I was not a huge Lucy fan. I know a lot of people are, and it's just a personal, you know, personal opinion, but I know a lot of people love Lucy. Here's one we haven't mentioned, Barry, and then we'll move on. But the Andy Griffith Show. How many people out there were fans of Barney Stinkin' Fife? I mean, that was a great character.
Yeah, it was actually so funny story. So it's just all of a sudden I got a big smile on my face. So when we went to wrestling, you know, my dad was friends with some of the wrestlers, and we would pick them up at the airport and we would drive them to the matches and then from the arena back too. And Bill Dromo, and my dad wasn't friends with Bill. My dad became very good friends with Bill Dromo. And Bill Dromo was just such a great guy. But Bill Dromo was part of a pack of wrestlers around 79 that were prelim workers in Florida. And it was Ray Candy, Bubba Douglas, Don Serrano, and Bill Dromo. And my dad was real friendly with Bubba Douglas, and we would pick them up at the airport, and Bill Dromo somehow he got involved in this group. So we would cram all four of those guys, me and my dad, in my dad's Cadillac, which really, you know, it's at this point everybody's jammed up, but it was pretty cool for a kid. But my Bill Dromo would sit in the passenger seat in the front, and he would call my dad Barney Fife the entire time that my dad was driving. And I just got such a kick out of that. And when you just said Barney Fife, that was the first thing I thought of. Andy Griffith Show was a great show. And I mean, obviously, you look at Ron Howard, who's one of the best movie directors out there, and got his start. I guess got his start in the Twilight Zone, but then he went right to the Andy Griffith Show. So let me ask you a question. So here's a good one. What would you consider, and I'm going to remove the Cosby Show because I just eviscerated that show, but what would you consider the worst sitcom of the 80s that was hugely popular?
There were some that really, you know, the one that popped into my mind. Well, two popped into my mind. The first one was, and I say that, and obviously if they were the worst, I really didn't spend a lot of time watching it. But the times I did happen to glance at it, I found them a little bit cringeworthy. One is The Facts of Life. And the other one is what the hell with Gary Coleman and Todd Bridges. Oh. And
what you talking about, Willis?
Yeah. Well, I can't remember Different the name. Different Strokes. Yeah.
That was cringeworthy. That was absolutely horrific. I think for me, it was Family Ties. There was a tone to that show. It was not funny. And Michael J. Fox, certainly, Back to the Future is one of my favorite movies, but there was something really off about that show. It just wasn't funny. And there was this laugh track to it that didn't work. But hey, so I want to take this. You just mentioned The Facts of Life. I was going to do an F. I'll do it. Fuck F, Mary, Kill on The Facts of Life. Give me your F, your Mary, and your Kill. I don't know why I'm saying F when I curse all throughout the entire episode. Say profanity. But I'm just used to F, Mary, Kill, I guess. So your F, Mary, Kill on The Facts of Life.
I guess I'll F Blair. I'm saying this and I actually know the characters' names about how much I hate the show, but I knew the characters' names. I don't know the character's name that Nancy McKeon played, but I will.
Joe.
I'll marry her and I'll kill Charlotte Ray was old, then I'll kill Charlotte Ray.
That's elder abuse. So I would agree on your F and Mary, and I think because the blonde was the hot one, but Joe was the one you'd want to be with long term. Yeah. It was, I guess, the heavy set one.
You're going to kill the fat one. That is fat shaming.
I didn't want to say it, but yeah, I think something about her. She was this heavy set Jewish girl that was, I guess, she was logical, but she was yet a little whiny. And I can't take the whiny aspect. I get it with killing Mrs. Ray. She's still alive, by the way, Charlotte Ray, yeah, Mrs. Garrett. Right. Still a living. She's got to be 90 at this point.
I want to just congratulate you on the political tap dancing of not killing Tootie and then being called a racist for killing the black chick.
Yeah. Actually, I got to admit, I thought Tootie was kind of hot. I had no problem with Tootie.
She actually ended up being a pretty attractive woman. Yeah, I remember.
She absolutely, and knowing my Pam Grier fetish, I have no problem with that. Yeah, so I heard this past week. They're looking at moving. And I can't take credit for this, but they're looking at moving the Tampa Bay Rays out of Tampa. They're not drawing. The team is in complete shambles. The owners are bigger fuck ups than the Miami Marlins owners have been.
Yeah, that's a debatable point at this.
Yeah, and that really says a lot. But they're looking at moving the team out of Tampa, and one of the cities that they want to move them to is Charlotte. But there's a hesitancy because they would then be known as the Charlotte Rays. And there's an issue with that.
I've never heard that. They would have to have her image as the logo.
She would have to, right?
Okay, Barry, before we get too much in this, because we still got to discuss the Cannon Group. Very quick. Van Halen, David Lee Roth, or Sammy Hagar?
David Lee Roth, but I will, and that's an easy one for me. Dave, what he did is my youth. It was a different band. But I got an appreciation for Sammy Hagar really within the last 5 or 6 years. But it is David Lee Roth.
And that question was posed by Nick Besance. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. I agree. You know, here's the thing about Van Halen. David Lee Roth was a better frontman, but Sammy Hagar, I thought, had a better voice.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and so that's why, you know, if you're going to, you know, when I saw Van Halen with my daughter, Dave had come back to the band and his voice, you could tell his voice was really starting to go. And they had, you know, his Eddie's 16-year-old kid playing bass instead of Michael Anthony. But you don't have Michael Anthony doing the backing vocals, which really, especially when Dave's voice is shot, it kind of, you can really notice it. But yeah, so Hagar, you know, and I know God knows there's a zillion stories about that breakup of that band and everything that go on. So one last thing before we get into the final moment, Barry, just a couple of anniversaries of some deaths. Ray Candy, you just mentioned Ray Candy, May 23rd, 94. So we're looking at 24-year anniversary of Ray Candy. Ray Candy, when he was in Georgia, he was a pretty big deal. And it wasn't until he came down to Florida, 83, 84-ish, as Mr. Kareem Muhammad, as one of the
Zambui
group?
Express.
The Zambui Express, yes. So we acknowledge the anniversary of his passing. May 20th, 2011. It's been 7 years since the Macho Man, Randy Savage, left us.
Yeah, and so if I can talk about Ray Candy for a second,
sure, absolutely.
This will be a great eight hour episode. So, who was it this past week that said? Was it Charles Devlin? I think it was Charles Devlin said, "Wow, you guys with these episodes." I'm like, "Yeah, next week we're going to do 6 hours." So Ray Candy was part of that group, the prelim group that I just mentioned that was friendly, and we first saw Ray down in Florida in '76. He was a main event guy. And then semi-main event, and came back in 79, and then for some reason was put into this prelim tag team with Bubba Douglas, and they got a little bit of a push, nothing serious, but they got over. He left, he came back early 80s, I think it was 82 or so, 81, and he was the masked Superfly, and that didn't work, but came back as one half of the Zambui Express. And that actually did work, and that was a perfect role. Ray was one of the nicest people I have ever met in my life. In and out of wrestling, doesn't matter. He was that nice. He was real. He was genuine. He was humble. And he was one of my father's favorite people, along with Bubba Douglas. Loved both those guys to death, and so did I. And when Ray Candy died, only once have I ever written a letter to the Wrestling Observer, and that was at Ray Candy's death. Just basically saying that, you know, I never felt that he got the respect he deserved in professional wrestling, and certainly as a wrestler he was limited, but as a human being, there was nobody finer than Ray Candy, just a great guy.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, a guy, for those of you that don't remember, in Georgia was a huge star as the Candyman, Ray Candy. I saw him actually work a spot show in my grandmother Corrine's hometown of Beaufort, South Carolina, mid-70s, teaming with Charlie Cook. And so, you know, a guy that we remember along with Randy Savage in the memory of their anniversary of their deaths. So now, that being said, Barry, it is finally time, and I know you are stoked for this, to talk about the Cannon Group. And there is a movie on Netflix that you you turned me on to. So, Barry, why don't you give a little detail on that?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So, you know, the 1980s for me, and so this does go back to the Dave Dixon conversation, is that a lot of my youth, and I think a lot of how I look at things now, and certainly as I was, you know, a young adult, was really formed at an early age. And professional, you know, my dad took me when I was 6 or 7 years old to professional wrestling, and we started going on a regular basis when I was 7 years old. And this wasn't the cartoonish, you know, mid-80s WWF. This was like, you know, Paul Jones throwing the belt off and that kind of shit. And it was hardcore. And Buddy Colt, like, destroying people. So it certainly is going to twist you up a little bit. And I think that's what happened with me. But in the mid-80s, pardon me, I found myself really gravitating towards, quote-unquote, low-budget, kind of terrible movies, but appreciating them and truly enjoying them for what they are. And, you know, every year, all these movies would win Oscars, you know, and I would sit there and go, that's like the worst fucking movie ever. It's the most boring movie I've ever seen in my life. And it's not a movie that I could watch over and over. And to me, and I've said this a million times on this show, a good movie is a movie that I can watch repetitively. If I can watch it, you know, look, Roadhouse isn't going to win any awards on storyline or acting, and it's as pretty, you know, a five-year-old could have written Roadhouse. At the same time, if it's on, I'm sitting there and leave me alone because I want to watch it. Well, Cannon in the mid-80s was kind of the poster child for movies that were being made on low budget, a script that was maybe made in 2 or 3 days and then shot in just a week or two. And a lot of these movies are considered terrible. And to that degree, some of these movies really are terrible and some of them are unwatchable. At the same time, they made some really good movies. They also made a lot of really, really watchable movies. And you and I both had the pleasure, and I highly recommend this, to watch a movie called Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films. And it's basically, it focuses, and I didn't know this until I did a little bit of research, but Canon had been around since the 70s. But Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, who were two cousins from Israel, who had made money and financed movies in Israel, kind of took over Canon. They purchased it, and they took over Canon in the 80s, and they started making movies, and they were making movies at the rate of one per week in some cases, and these movies were being released. And, you know, you can't do quote-unquote great art that quickly, but you can do some really fun stuff. And the 80s were great because this was kind of the era of low-budget horror movies, or maybe the teen sex comedies, and you had all these companies, whether it was Empire Films or Troma, New Line Cinema, Atlantic Releasing Corporation, and even Orion. And Orion actually made some very good movies, but at the same time, they made some shit as well. But Canon was the leader, and if you say shitty, and I don't mean that in a bad way in any way, but if you say shitty 80s movie, somebody's going to say, oh yeah, it was a Canon film. You know, it's definitely a Canon film. So you and I both watched this this documentary on Canon films, and I had wanted to see this for years, and I searched Netflix. Thank you, God, for Netflix, who's ever come up with Netflix, because it's changed the way that I view TV. And I sat there and I watched this, and there was a big wet spot on the couch when I was done. I was so excited. This was such an exciting, fun film for me. And all the quotes from Menachem Golan. And Menachem Golan was kind of the visionary of Canon Films as far as getting movies made. And Globus was kind of the financier of getting the money for the films. He was maybe a little more reserved, you know, maybe a little more intelligent. But Golan was larger than life. And, you know, if he had a vision, you know, we're going to make a movie and it's going to be the greatest movie of all time. And we're going to make it on $1 million. And then the movie, you see it and you go, oh my God, what a fucking train wreck here. But he was great. You know, he was everything, in my opinion, that it typifies Canon Films in a nutshell, Menachem Golan and his quotes. And every time he did an interview, he was great for a soundbite. So, you know, very exciting to me. But I know that you saw the movie and immediately you were like, wow, this was pretty good. And I'm like, we should do an episode on Canon Films because, A, we discuss movies a lot. We discuss movies that we like, which are not considered works of art. And it's occasionally that work of art slips in there. But a lot of art, the people who listen to us, and thank you for listening to us, and guys like Daniel Balderson, you know, guys who like these B movies, Canon was it. Canon was it for the 80s when it came to this actual genre of film.
Well, you know, there's a certain appreciation of being able to watch a movie that you know is a bad film. And you appreciate the fact that this is kind of a piece of shit film, but it's so bad. It's like, you know, Mystery Science Theater, the old TV show. That was what the whole show was based on, was watching bad movies. And I'm not sure if they ever actually, they usually did sci-fi movies, but or monster movies. But a couple of things. What was the film? I think it was like something like The Lemon Popsicle or something like that. It was like one of the first movies. What was it?
Yeah, so it was apparently they were doing something in England, at least 3 hours of sleep creeping up on me. So they were, and this was out of my, I did not know about this. They did the Lemon Popsicle sequels, and it was this genre of film that they were producing in Israel. And I guess it was the most low budget, unethical kind of teen sex comedy. It would put all the teen sex comedies that we had here, like Private School and The Last American Virgin, would put all these to shame. These were apparently as gratuitous and bottom feeding as you could possibly get.
Yeah, and the reason I mention that is The Lemon Popsicle was the movie that was the genesis for Porky's, because it was basically right. The same plot, and except they show you a clip from Lemon Popsicle, and as dare I say, gratuitous as Porky's was, this was a different level. Like you know, just gratuitous, no reason, but the girl was taking her top off, which God knows there's nothing wrong with that. But anyway, that was, you know, they would come up with these ideas And I remember the story that was being told in the Netflix film about when he introduced himself as being affiliated with the movie, the producers that made this movie, how completely horrified people were, because around Israel, this movie had a reputation of being this completely horrible film that nonetheless was hugely popular.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I pulled up, I think it was through YouTube, but I pulled up some of the Lemon Popsicle series, and it's almost unwatchable. I mean, I guess if you're in Israel, it's different, but as far as for me, it was almost unwatchable in a lot of ways, and it was very, the acting was terrible, the writing was terrible, everything about it was terrible, but apparently these movies made a shit ton of money over in Israel.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea, excuse me, of some of the films we're talking about, Good and Bad, from the Cannon Group. We're talking Sylvester Stallone in Cobra, Chuck Norris in Delta Force and Invasion USA. Charles Bronson made a bunch of movies with the Cannon Group. A movie that I've referenced before, Kinjite, Forbidden Subjects. Meryl Streep, Cry in the Dark. Jean-Claude Van Damme, Bloodsport. John Voight, this was actually a really good Cannon film. John Voight and Runaway Train with Eric Roberts. That was a really good one. Invasion from Mars, 52 Pickup with Anne Margaret and Roy Scheider. So, you know, here you have in that group I mentioned, Barry, you've got some really pretty bad movies, but you've also got some movies that are really good, too.
Yeah, so you know, it's funny. So as I went through the list of every Cannon film ever made, and I one of my lists that I made was good films, which literally were good films. And you just mentioned two of them. Runaway Train is a good film. There's no getting around. It's well acted. It's well directed. It actually made some money. It's a great movie. 52 Pickup, I think, is one of the most underrated movies of the 1980s. And I didn't realize that was a Cannon film because it's way too good to be a Cannon film. It should not. There's no flaw in that film. I don't understand. Roy Scheider, Anne Margaret, John Glover, Clarence Williams III. And if you've never seen this movie, John Glover, who's blackmailing Roy Scheider because he's having an affair, this is a good movie. And this guy, John Glover, was a hell of an actor who never really broke through to become big. But my favorite Cannon movie of all time, as far as a good movie, because I have my favorites, which are not considered good movies, was a movie called Barfly, and it's Mickey Rourke and Faye Dunaway from 1988, directed by Barbet Schroeder, and it's based off of Charles Bukowski, who's my favorite author. And, you know, this is, if you've never seen Barfly, essentially Mickey Rourke is a guy that is a severe, and I'm not talking, you know, a functioning alcoholic. He is a severe alcoholic, but this movie all takes place literally within a bar, and and actually Frank Stallone's in this movie, and he plays the bartender, the owner of the bar, and Mickey Rourke is kind of a guy that does odds and ends at the bar, but essentially he's a guy that once he's got money, he's drinking at the bar. But these people are a complete mess, but what a wonderful film.
Faye Dunaway too, right, Barry?
Did I say Anne Bancroft? I meant Faye Dunaway. I'm sorry. Yeah. I always got these two confused. But it is funny. I pull up this list, and this is the only three movies that I can consider as being – and that Meryl Streep movie, To Cry in the Dark, obviously is a good movie as well. But they did make some good movies. And when you and I were talking off air, I said, do you think these movies were good by mistake? Like, you know, because how is it possible that these guys made hundreds of movies and they're all – bad, but then they make like four or five good movies. That couldn't have been on purpose. They were making good movies, right?
No, and you know, I remember Bloodsport was like really the breakout movie for Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's a really good action, entertaining movie. I remember Bolo Young. Young was the lead heel in the movie that in the championship fight, and was just shredded. I mean, he was jacked up to the gills like you've never seen a guy in any kind of – and he does – there's a great scene in the movie where right before he fights, he looks at his opponent and then he blows the snot rocket. And it's something right out of a pro wrestling match, and you're going, how did this guy not transition? How did they not grab this guy, whether it was, you know, the WWF, and pull him in for some sort of spot – because, or even like a New Japan or All Japan, because this guy, man, he would have been money.
They brought in Tiny Lister, Zeus.
Yeah, and exactly.
Exactly. This guy, you're 100%, because this guy looked evil. The other guy looked to me, looked like an actor, kind of. And they would, he had like 6-inch lifts in his shoes and shit. This guy looks like a beast, this Bolo Young. But you watch him as an actor, and some of the, when he breaks the one guy's neck and he does this bug-eyed, crazy look on his face. You're 100% right. So you just mentioned the three most prolific actors for Canon Films. And if you've seen a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, a Chuck Norris movie, or a Charles Bronson movie, you've seen a Canon movie. Because in the 80s, when these gentlemen were making their movies, they were making them all through Canon. So here's a fact. And again, this is the beauty of when we decide to do a little research and dive deep. Do you know Jean-Claude Van Damme's debut in America and what film it occurred? And it's a Canon film. I had no idea.
Actually, it's something like Black Eagle. Was that
it? No, it was Breakin'. So somehow.
Now I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Somehow they had gotten Jean-Claude, and they talk about Jean-Claude Van Damme, or, you know, in the documentary, and how he kind of got into Canon Films, and it was kind of unique, and really it was his career. But he is, during one of the breakdancing sequences that takes place outside, and I think it's at Venice Beach, he is in the crowd. He's there. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I went back, and I have Breakin' on my DVR. I went back and I watched it. I'm like, holy shit, there he is. But Jean-Claude Van Damme made a half dozen movies for Canon. Chuck Norris, almost his entire career in the 80s. And some of these movies, they're good. I mean, they're not bad. You know, Code of Silence, which I think is our favorite, was actually by Orion, if I'm correct. But
yeah, that was not a Canon film. I actually looked at that because that's what I thought. But, you know, one of the things we talk about, and here's a common theme that runs through these films, you know, the action exploitation films. I mentioned Cobra, Delta Force, Invasion USA, you know, Kenjite, Bloodsport. So here, look at Cobra. You've got Stallone. The actor's name was Brian Thompson, who played, you know, the Night Stalker in that. And Delta Force, I believe the lead heel was a guy that we've mentioned here before. Was it Robert Forster?
Oh, absolutely. We just mentioned him, I think, last week or the week before.
Yeah. Kenjite, I don't remember the name of the actor, the really sleazy actor who was the child molester that Bronson ends up catching. So we got Bolo Young and Bloodsport. And let me look up Barry. Keep going. I'll mention the name of the guy in Invasion USA. That's another guy that we've mentioned
before. Richard Lynch?
Richard Lynch. Thank you, Ned. Now I don't have to look it up. But he was a guy that was in Bullet, and he was in The Seven Ups. He's a great actor that's always plays the villain. He's this kind of blonde-haired, sort of quasi-good-looking guy, and he always plays the heel in the movies. And what, much like a pro wrestling match, what made guys like Stallone and Bronson and Norris and Van Damme great is when they have a great heel to play off of. And every one of those movies, they had a great heel to play off of.
Oh, absolutely. And that's so for years I said, if you ever watch the television show Dexter, while Dexter was a great character, they would introduce it was a pro wrestling thing in a sense. They would introduce a new heel every year. And every year this was the new antagonist. So, yeah, you're 100% right. But, you know, you look at Charles Bronson's 1980 career, and they talk about Bronson in this documentary, how he basically was just sleepwalking through his roles to get – he knew he was making shitty movies, but he was getting paid. He was still acting, which is, I guess, what he wanted to do. But, you know, guys like Norris, Van Damme, Bronson, you know, all these movies were all made by Canon. And you've got, you know, Chuck Norris's movies were all pretty similar. There's a lot of, you know, you can tweak them tiny bit, but they're essentially almost all the same movie, except for the Code of Silence, actually, which was a little different. The rest are all kind of similar, but Canon was the company that produced this. So I started going through this. And another thing that Canon did, and they addressed this, and I can't stress enough, watch this documentary, Electric Boogaloo, was the fascination that these two older Israeli men had with ninja movies. And Canon released five ninja movies in the 1980s. The first was Enter the Ninja, followed by Revenge of the Ninja, and this starred Sho Kusugi. And I think we just talked about him recently as well. And he was a guy that he would be in the background, have these supporting roles in certain movies. But, you know, Cannon saw star material here, and they gave him the lead in these two movies. And then Ninja 3, The Domination came out, and they flipped it, and they got rid of Sho Kasugi, and they starred Lucinda Dickey. And Lucinda Dickey was more famous from Breakin'. She was in Breakin' 1 and 2, where she is the classical dancer that they bring into the hip-hop world. And then you had, I take it back, it was actually six movies. Then you start American Ninja with the great Michael Dudikoff. So at this point, Sho Kasugi is out, and Dudikoff is taking over. And, you know, this was kind of, when you say Cannon Films to some people, they say, oh yeah, you mean Michael Dudikoff, the American Ninja. And he made two ninja movies, which was American Ninja 1 and 2. And two actually starred Steve James along with him. And we know Steve James because he was in the great movie To Live and Die in L.A. And Steve James was an African-American karate master, I think with limited acting experience. And if I'm correct, if I remember the Steve James story correctly, he was teaching karate to certain Hollywood stars, and he broke in the business that way. And you'll know him. He was in a bunch of movies, obviously To Live and Die in L.A., I think was maybe his most mainstream role, and that was a fantastic movie. That's not canon by any stretch. But Steve James continued. He was then in American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt, but at this point, Dudikoff had left, and they had replaced him with some guy named David Bradley that I'm not familiar with. So it was funny where, you know, Cannon saw kind of that, okay, wait a minute. So if we make a movie and it costs us $2 million, we can, you know, and Golan's got this philosophy, and it was one of his quotes, and he said something like, I'll never understand how if you make a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you spend $5 million, how you're not making money. And that $5 million seems high to me because I don't think there were a lot of Cannon movies. Stallone's movie, Over the Top, for sure, and Cobra, you know, definitely, because Stallone apparently wanted like $12 million bucks or something, or got $12 million for making these movies. But, you know, just I love how they were doing certain themes. And I like the fact that, you know, they got with Van Damme. Well, fuck it. We're going to go film over the course of 3 or 4 years. We're going to go do 4 or 5 kickboxing movies. And Ninja, we like this Ninja with the throwing of the stars. So we're going to do over 5 or 6 years, we'll do 6 movies. You know, they kind of settled on these themes. To that end, these movies were actually making some money, which is shocking, but they were actually making some money.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking was they almost have a philosophy of they would make 20 films. Let's just pick a random number. And if 2 or 3 of them made money, it made back the money that the other 17 didn't. And yep. That was their philosophy was almost let's throw as much shit against the wall as we can because something's going to stick. And by God, out of those 20 movies, if those 3 movies hit and made them some money, it kept them going. And that's exactly what their whole thing was. And by the way, allow me to mention, because I'm not positive, but this may in fact have been a Cannon film. The film I referenced earlier, Black Eagle, since you brought up the name Sho Kasugi, starred Sho Kasugi and Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's why I'm thinking this might have been a Cannon film too. That came out in 1988, and that movie was famous for introducing mainly Van Damme to the American audience because there's a great scene where they're down, I want to say about the docks, and there's these 2 barrels of oil that are lying on the ground, and Van Damme goes and as a part of, you know, he's the he actually plays a heel in the movie, but he does this split where he's got the 2 oil barrels on side of it, but there's a space in between him, and he does this full split just to show off his incredible dexterity and just being able to the muscle strength that he has, like in his upper legs and his groin. And I remember that was 30 years ago, and I can remember being at the theater seeing this movie. I actually went to a theater to see a Sho Kasugi movie and thinking, holy shit, how does that guy do that? You know, and you were introduced to this guy, and it was soon after that that it was Bloodsport, and you're like, oh, that's the guy that was in Black Eagle. So yeah, Black Eagle is a movie that, let's be honest, it was not a great film. I just looked it up on IMDb. I gave it 3.8, which is, that's not a good score. But, you know, it was a fun, dumb movie, and it introduced the world to Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, so I don't think Black Eagle was a canon movie, but they could have been tied, because apparently they were financing other movies as well, so it's possible. I think part of it too, and you just said this, and this really resonated with me, was I saw a lot of these movies in the theater. And this was a period where I had gone from New York City to Los Angeles, and New York City had 42nd Street at this time, which was the absolute dregs of the earth. Everything that you've heard about 42nd Street, and you look, one of our favorite TV shows takes place right there. If anything, it doesn't make it scuzzy enough, because it really was, 42nd Street was a foul, disgusting area to be in. That being said, all of these movies were playing on 42nd Street, and you can go see them for $5, usually a double feature. So, you know, I could have gone to nicer movie theaters to see other movies, or you walk down 42nd Street and you get to see two of these movies for $5 or $6. So I did see a lot of canon films in the theater. Going out to Los Angeles, especially, you know, that 86 to 88 period when I was there, in 85 also, they were all up and down Hollywood Boulevard. You know, I remember going in and seeing Shokasugi movies in the theaters and getting popcorn and going and sitting down, but really having so much fun, because this was complete and utter mindless escapism. And that's what, again, that's, I think, one of the great things about film. And film to, you know, people, it's a lot of different things. You know, we can watch it for mindless escapism. At the same time, occasionally, if I'm lucid, I like to think. But one of the things that they did was, this is what made me think of it. So on 42nd Street in 1984, I actually saw the movie Bolero on its opening day. And I don't know what possessed me to go. My thinking is probably they said that Bo Derek was going to be nude a lot in the movie, and that's probably why I went. Because Bolero, if you've ever seen it, it's almost unwatchable. But there are two things that make it stand out, and one is that Bo
there
Derek
are two things that stand out. What are you trying to say?
Well, exactly. Well, there's actually four things on that note that stand out. One is two of those belong to Bo Derek, because she's topless throughout a great portion of this movie. The second aspect of this is that the young lady who played the older sister in the movie The Wonder Years, and we didn't discuss The Wonder Years. We're talking about great sitcoms, because that was a great show.
Absolutely. That was probably the best sitcom of the 80s, I'm going to say.
Yeah. Well, cheers to me. But yeah, I like that. But Olivia Diabo was her name, and she was fucking hot. Well, she is, if I'm correct, had just turned 18 in this movie, and there's a scene where she's getting a bath, and women are bathing her, and she's completely topless, and it's great. And that could be another reason that I went. Maybe I knew that, you know, some hot chick was going to be. But Cannon also did that. Besides a lot of these action sequences and action films that they were putting out, there was a lot of gratuitous nudity. A lot of it pointless, just going in movies. And they released a movie in the late 80s that I saw. I think it was 88 or 89, and it was called Track 29, and it starred Teresa Russell. Teresa Russell was married to Nicholas Rogue, and he was the director of the David Bowie movie called The Man Who Fell to Earth, if you've ever seen it. And Teresa Russell had to be 20 years younger than this guy, maybe even more, and she was really hot. She was tall. She had a perfect body. She had long, straight. She was like, if I was creating my own weird science and I was drawing somebody up, Teresa Russell probably would have been it.
Teresa Russell, excuse me, Barry, just interrupt. Wasn't she the lead in Black Widow?
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah, that's okay. A great movie that nobody ever talks about. But she was the lead in that movie. But in this movie, and I can't tell you what this movie's about, because I don't think even when I saw the movie, I understood what the fuck was going on. It's really out there. But she gets nude in this movie as well, and that just makes it worthwhile to me to be watching this movie. So they did a lot of that with just throwing in nudity, and it worked. It certainly worked on me, because I know I went and saw a bunch of their films based off of that.
So, okay. Yeah. You know, as you said that, it reminded me, one of the shows that, I've said before that I liked as a show on Cinemax called Strike Back. And it's an action, you know, soldiers of fortune kind of thing. But it seemed like every single episode of Strike Back that you watch, there's like a moment where somebody just drops their clothes and screws somebody. And I'm like, where did that come from? I mean, I'm not disagreeing with it, but it just seemed kind of out there. So, okay, Barry, it's about time for us to wrap things up here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Well,
before we do, Jeff, I got to throw a couple more things out at you about this. Quickly, I just want to talk about the amount of films. The most prolific years that Canon had as far as releasing films were 86 and 87. They released 68 movies within those 2 years.
Wow.
88 went down to 30, and by 89, which was pretty much where it was over, they only did 17 films. But before we do wrap this up, let me ask you a question. What are give me your top five, if you can, your top five favorite Canon films.
You're talking about favorite, like they're good movies, or just favorite bad movies, or both?
I said, Jeff, these five are going to be on cable. Ones that you would sit down and you'd watch because you enjoy them. They don't have to be good. Just your favorite.
I would say I'll go Delta Force, Invasion USA, Bloodsport, Kinjite. Kinjite is just a great bad movie. And my number one, even though Runaway Train is a really good film, you know, I've mentioned before that every time Cobra's on, I have to watch it because it's just so profoundly stupid, but it's stupid in such a fun way that you can't look away.
It's great.
So what about you?
So my number one is Breakin', which is one of my favorite guilty pleasure movies of all time. I can watch Breakin' 24 hours a day. The movie Life Force, which was directed by Toby Hooper, who had done Texas Chainsaw Massacre, about these aliens that suck the life out of you. And this beautiful woman, Jeff Zinger, this one's for you, Matilda May, who just is naked throughout the whole movie. Bloodsport, which you just mentioned, I think is fantastic. I can watch it. Forrest Whitaker in Bloodsport. I can watch that anytime. My number four would be, I'll say Barfly, just because I think that is a tremendous movie. And my number five is Cyborg, Jean-Claude Van Damme. And the antagonist in this movie is Vincent Klin, who is in one of my favorite movies, Point Break. He plays the bad guy in that movie. So let me ask you another question, then we definitely can wrap it up so we don't make it a 40-hour show. What do you think the top grossing Canon movie was of all time?
I'm going to go Delta Force.
Delta Force, Jeff, number four, at $17,768,000. So I will say Chuck Norris comes in at number two with Missing in Action, number four with Delta Force, number five with Invasion USA. So that really says something. Out of the top five grossing Canon movies, Chuck Norris is in three of those.
Before you bump in, I just want to make one quick comment about Invasion USA. What I remember about Invasion USA was Joe Bob Briggs, who is a great writer that I know you've read, had Invasion USA as the number one film for the longest time, having the highest body count of any film that ever came out. I'm sure it's been topped, but for many years, Invasion USA had the high body count on the Joe Bob Briggs scale. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, you're good, too. So looking at that, Death Wish 3 came in at number 7, and then Jean-Claude Van Damme is number 9 and number 11. Number 9 is Kickboxer, number 11 with Bloodsport. Chuck Norris, again, number 12, Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, with $10 million. The number one Canon movie of all time, which was a surprise to me, but I love it, it's Breakin'. $38.5 million that movie made. Opened up on May the 4th, 1984.
Wow. That would not have been the one I picked. So, you know.
Me neither. If I didn't know it, I would never have guessed it.
Yeah. So anyway, folks, I think we've definitely hit the 2-hour mark. So it's time for us to go. I will say, please follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry is in fact a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. The great Brian Last, salute! Until next time, we'll see you, folks.